The Senate has to order. President or Senator Salo, Senator Duncan, Senator Miller, and myself, Senator Rieger. Purpose of today's hearing is to get a presentation on the fiscal notes on Senate Bill 270 and Senate Bill 284. And I believe that we have individuals from the Division of Insurance, from Department of Health and Social Services, and they're either here or they're on their way. Let's see. Dave, were you going to testify on these? Why don't you come up and give us a presentation about what's in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Walsh. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. And I want to start off by thanking the Chair and particularly Senator Duncan for their patience with us as we work through this process and tried to come up with some numbers. Senator Duncan was particularly kind in meeting with members of my staff and Health and Social Services earlier this week, and his input was very important in our determination on setting some of these final numbers. I understand that at the last hearing, which I attended by teleconference, there was an aside comment made about the number of people that I brought with me to these hearings. And as with the previous hearings, Mr. Chairman, I have a fairly full complement of people. And that's for a couple of reasons. The main one is statements have been made that would lead one to infer that the process that went into creating these fiscal notes from the division's point of view was one about which people might have some questions. My folks did this straight up and by the numbers with an instruction from me and my instruction from the commissioner to do it honestly and not to cook any numbers up or cook any numbers down. And I felt, and I still feel, that it's important to have those folks available to the committee for direct questions. Secondly, even without those types of statements, this is a complex exercise, and I think that it's important to have the people who have the direct knowledge available to the committee personally so that any questions can be answered by the people who know about the various aspects of the fiscal note. And third, I think it's just it's also nice and fair so that the people who do the work get some recognition for a job well done, and I think in this case, given the parameters, they have done a very good job. Mr. Chairman, every state is struggling with how to cost out health care reform. I was talking to the Commissioner of Insurance in Vermont on Monday of this week, and they are, I think it's fair to say, farther along in the process than we are, at least farther along in terms of the number of years they've been working on it. They have not come up with a number that they feel is a workable number, and their estimates are all over the block. And I also called other colleagues in other states that have or are going through the similar exercise, and they too don't really know how to put a hard number on what it is that health reform is going to cost. Mr. Chairman, what we've presented to the committee are four documents. First of all, a fiscal note on just the insurance portion of SB 270. Mr. Livey, perhaps he's walked in after we started, but I know, as you noted, Mr. Chairman, he is on his way, has, I think, the rest of the items with regard to 270, but this is just the insurance portion of it. Secondly, we have just the insurance portion of SB 284. That has gone down considerably after our conversations with Senator Duncan, and also based upon some of the changes in assumption that we have made with regard to the last two documents. The last two documents are essentially alternatives for 284. One of them, which is probably most easily identifiable because there's a very high capital expenditure in FY95, we are calling the in-house model, and the other one, which has a lower capital expenditure of $500,000 with the asterisk, we are calling the contract model. And we present both of these in draft form to the committee because we feel that the ultimate decision on which way to go is one that is probably a policy matter. Obviously, it is less expensive to contract out. And with the chair's permission, I would start with that fiscal note as a starting point for going through these. The first fiscal note that we did and passed out 2 weeks ago in draft form showed $19 million worth of expenditure in the first year. Of that, $12,000 was capital expenditure for, pardon me? What did I say? I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Sorry, Senator. Thank you. Well, it's, you know, it's Wednesday and it's golf day for us for the insurance people. So. It showed $19 million, thank you, Senator, of which $12 million was a capital expenditure, leaving an operating cost of a little over $7 million. By contracting out, that not only has an effect on the capital expenditure line, but it also has an effect on the operating line with less employees being hired. And a total operating expense of $5.5 million for the first year. The capital expense of $500,000 for the first 3 years is constant based upon the following assumption. First of all, that the contract is going to cost about $100,000 a year, and every time you add a different application, there's a one-time cost of about $400,000 per year. And we included that one-time cost for the first 3 years because it will take some time to get the federal waivers. And every time a new federal waiver is obtained, Mr. Hansen from Department of Health and Social Services felt that there would be this one-time cost. But because it is contracted out, the initial cost is obviously much less. There is still a big number for 98 because it's in 98 that Senate Bill 284 swings into action, I guess, for lack of a better word. And all of the capital expenditures, as you can see from the backup material, specifically on page 4, assume a decreasing claim rate equal to what Medicaid is currently paying. And Kim Bush and the folks over at Medicaid are quick to point out and to us, and we would be quick to point out to the chair and to the members of the committee, that this cost could be less, it could be more. It's just simply the best estimate that we have now of what processing these claims would cost. We also have reduced in both fiscal notes the number of staff positions, and we have I think done a tighter job with regard to travel and some of the ancillary expenses. And that is because we've had more time to do it, we have had more good minds on the effort, and we have also talked with Senator Duncan and others who know more about how this is intended to work and how it actually does work in terms of Medicare, Medicaid. But we feel fairly comfortable with the contracting out estimate of approximately $5.5 million the first year and then continuing with roughly that same figure for the first 3 years with then an increase in 98. The increase in 98 is, Mr. Chairman, highly speculative because it depends a lot on decisions that the corporation itself would make during those first 3 years about what to phase in, how to phase it in, and how best to do that from an economic and a service point of view. So the number in 98 we feel is within the zone of reasonableness, but we don't feel that it is anywhere near as hard as the numbers for the first 3 years. Now, the other alternative, which is what we call...
Excuse me, Senator Duncan?
Yeah, just on before you go off to the other one.
Yes.
Can I ask a question on this one?
Sure.
Yeah. Just on going to the 98 figure, Mr. Walsh, and I'm trying to find, get the asterisk by capital expenditure of $11 million, and I'm trying to find where that refers me in the backup on the first one.
The asterisk is down in the bottom on the first page analysis. The capital costs are based upon information provided by DHS.
I guess what I'm trying to determine then is that purchase of a mainframe?
I don't believe that it is. I think it has to do, and perhaps if someone from Health and Social Services is here, they can answer this more completely. But I think it has to do more with the added costs that come as they're set out on page 7 when page 4 when claims are actually processed. It's taking that Medicaid cost times the number of claims, and then projecting that out. I think that's where the additional.
Oh, okay. I see. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It shows as a capital expenditure, but I guess that really is contract.
It'd be contract
for computer space.
It actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Could I ask a further question of that?
I'd rather have Dave go all the way through his presentation.
And I'll come back to
you. Sure.
I'm actually close to being done, Mr. Chairman, because the other fiscal note is the assumption that this is done in-house by a mainframe, and as you can see, the main difference is in the capital expenditures, and then the effect that has on the operating positions that flow from that. But the is that we decided to present both of these in draft form simply because the second version is a rather radical departure in the assumptions that we made initially. And it's not to say that the initial assumptions were wrong. It's more a function of its time and additional information, et cetera. But it does present a basic policy question about which way to go, because there is certainly more front-end load for fiscal 95 in the in-house version. There is, however, in 98, an additional hit in capital in that year for the contract out version, and we thought it was appropriate to present both for the committee and let the committee decide which methodology they wanted to take. We have reached this position in talking with Health and Social Services as well as talking in-house, because there are some fundamental assumptions in terms of implementation and perhaps in terms of service levels that are different. Obviously, if you own your own store, you can tailor what you do to fit your own needs without having to worry about contract amendments. On the other hand, buying a mainframe and doing the necessary programming in-house is expensive up front. That, Mr. Chairman, it constitutes the formal remarks I would like to make. If there are any questions that I or the staff can answer, or the people from Health and Social Services.
Just one, and then Senator Duncan has a question. On the fund source, on 270, I'm trying to think back to the transmittal letter, but 270, the fund source is listed as GF program receipts. And as I recall, that was from the insurance premium tax. Now, will that change with the, if the Division of Insurance regulates health insurance, does your revenue change at all, or does the state's revenue change? Is there some kind of a filing fee or processing fee, or is the premium tax paid regardless of your status?
The premium tax is paid regardless of our status. We collect two types of monies. The general fund program receipts to which that transmittal letter refers deals with the premium tax that is paid, and right now that's somewhere around $27 million, maybe 26. We also collect a little shy of $4 million in fees that fund the operation of the Division of Insurance. 270, it's my understanding, would be funded from the premium tax and not from the fee portion, because we really couldn't charge for
that. And will your fees change if you have coverage of disability insurance?
It'll probably change a little, but not substantially. We may see some increase. In fact, we would need to see some increase in fees for the additional positions, but it would be in an amount that would just cover those additional positions.
Oh, it's just a cost recovery.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Senator Duncan.
Thank you. Just a couple of general questions. Mr. Walsh, I'm just wondering why, and maybe, for example, on the portion that deals with the division of insurance for both bills, for 270 and for 284, mm-hmm. funding source, why can't the funding source be the same for both bills? Why can't it be general fund program receipts for both bills instead of general fund for one and general fund program receipts for the other? What's the difference?
I honestly don't know, Joan.
The reason is that 270.
Why don't you come up to the table and state your name?
Mr. Chairman, this is Joan Brown, who's the administrative officer, and she's the one who does the fiscal notes, does the budget, and keeps us.
My name is Joan Brown, administrative officer for the Division of Insurance. In 270, there's specific language that references the funding through the premium tax. That language does not exist in 284.
Of course, the specific language is just as everything else in 270. It says the legislature may appropriate premium tax as a funding source, not shall. And, of course, fiscal note, I mean, that language is not even necessary. I mean, the funding source can be determined by the fiscal note. So I'm just wondering why, you know, it's a point I think that we should have consistency, because unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, as comments I've heard from some legislators believe that if you use premium tax, it doesn't cost anything.
Well, that if
it's almost like it's free money, right?
Well, yeah, I guess in one sense it is, but it's money that the legislature already has, and if you chose to appropriate the $30 million for some other purpose, whatever it's funding now would go wanting.
No, I mean, I understand it's general fund money, no matter what, right? Because if you don't use the premium taxes to fund 270, it's available to fund your division, for example.
Well,
or somewhere.
Somewhere.
It's available for something.
Yeah.
It's general fund. So it's just as misleading, Mr. Chairman, between the two bills, because some folks have said, well, as long as Senate Bill 270 doesn't cost any, it doesn't require new money, we'll fund it. Well, they both require general fund. That's the bottom line. Or they both require funding from premium tax. I'm just wondering how it's not consistent.
Well, I think you've made your point, Senator.
Well, but. I'm just wondering if there isn't any reason why we couldn't do that on the fiscal system, on the funding sources.
Well, I think that that was basically the gist of my question. If this isn't new fees because of the regulation of health insurance, I would think that an existing revenue source fiscally will regard as being something that's being taken away from what could be used from other purposes in the general fund. So,
right.
You know, in that context, I think the points have been made.
So then it should be general fund?
Probably. But, you know.
Okay, I just want to make the point.
Finance Committee would definitely be aware of that if it's coming out of new money or.
I know. I just want to make the point for other people who are in the room so we can understand.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. Maybe two other questions. On the fiscal note on 284, I'm just looking at one contract now. Okay. Public involvement process, public hearing process, is about $1 million. Where did you get those figures for teleconference hearings and all that?
We took, we went through the bill and figured the number of regs that would have to be prepared. And also the points in the bill where public involvement was referred to, and we made a chart, which I believe we submitted to the committee a couple of hearings a couple of weeks ago. I know I have it here, and as we talk, I'll find it. We then estimated, based upon our experience with regard to regulations, and from the experience of other divisions, what it would, what a reasonable hearing time would be We made a couple of assumptions. We assumed that only four of the commissioners would have to travel, that they would all be held out of one site, so as opposed to having the commission go to Nome or Barrow or wherever, they would all be held in one site and that they would be teleconferenced. And then we called the LIO and figured out the costs, and then it was just a simple arithmetic function.
That's a good explanation for that, and I guess it's. I guess I wanted to be able to. I know that the fiscal note for Senate Bill 270, the major one on 270, wasn't prepared by Mr. Walsh. It was prepared by Mr. Magic. So I wanted to ask. I wanted to compare that provision in both bills because in the. I guess it's not fair with Mr. Walsh sitting here. The Senate Bill 270 doesn't have anything in it for teleconferencing costs or public hearing type cost, public involvement cost at all. It just has $17,000 for travel, which includes travel cost per diem, research investigation, public hearings, $17,000. I just wanted to be sure that we had looked at that in the other fiscal notes. I guess I need to hold that question for Mr. Nysick. Is someone going to testify on the Senate Bill 270 fiscal note other than Mr. Walsh?
I think Jay Livey was going to testify. And the Commissioner of Admin was just here, but I think Jay will, at least on the Office of the Governor section.
Could I ask him on that question now, or do you want to hold
it? Sure. Sure. Why don't you come state your name for the record?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Jay Livey from Health and Social Services. Senator Duncan, on the version that was just passed out, and it's got a handwritten date on the top of 3/23/94?
Yes.
Okay. In there, on page, in the backup, there should have been amount in there for $31,700 for teleconferencing sites. I'm sorry, $31,500 under communications. That was a cost that that was added. That's not in the original.
Not. I've got one that's written on top right there. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, in addition, Senator Duncan was right that in addition we put some money in there for travel, the $17,000, some of which would be used for commissioners to travel to hold public hearings in communities.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might pursue that just for a moment so I can understand, then for the governor's bill, for the public hearing, public involvement process, so it will be sure to have citizens involved in this from the outset, it costs $31,000, and for 284, it's $1 million.
Mr. Chairman, if I can jump in, I handed Senator Duncan a copy of the chart, which I located. Part of that is based, in fact, a lot of it is based upon the regulations that 270 requires. And I couldn't go down this list. I mean, we listed these by statute, by section reference. And I couldn't off the top of my head go down the list and check off the ones that 284 also has. But I think it's reasonable to say that a lot of what is called for in 284 in terms of regulations is not called for in 270. And so that's why I think that's one reason why the figure would be different.
I can say that the way we came up with the 31,500 number is we just looked at the cost of teleconference, which is approximately $800 an hour, assuming that it has to be fully paid for by the commission and there's no sponsorship from legislators. And assumed three one-hour teleconferences per month to all sites, 22 sites on the system. And that works out to, approximately $31,500 per month or per year. We're assuming that some of those won't be to all sites. There'll be different combinations of teleconferences held in conjunction with travel also.
So on the person of Senate Bill 270, you know, this commission has a broad range of powers. I'll just try to find the site that I want to describe. There's, hang on just a second, let me try to find it, but. Somewhere there is, oh, it's on second page, defining a range of potential benefit packages. What was the process in your fiscal note that, fiscal note, or how would you, how do you envision that that particular piece of the bill would be implemented?
Mr. Chairman, we, as you know, the fiscal note, there are three paid commissioners and three research analysts who are full-time staff. My assumption is one way that the commission could organize their work, because the benefit package would be a major piece of their function, that you would have a commissioner and a research analyst assigned to doing that particular piece of it. And so you'd have two full-time staff involved. They may have to pull in additional resources from around state government, but essentially those two would be responsible for that piece. Other pieces of the work could be assigned the same way. For example, the data collection. Another piece could be assigned based on watching the federal reform pieces of legislation. But that would be one way that they could organize the work anyway.
I just want to follow up on the public hearing process. I'm going to beat this to death. But I think that's an important part of both bills, and especially both bills. But under 270, for example, there's going to be, because of the narrowness of the board, it'll be limited public involvement. There will be only three members on the board. It'll be limited public involvement. And there's no travel money, basically, in the fiscal note for 270. And just as I look at the sheet that Mr. Walsh handed out to me, you know, just the meetings it's going to take for grievance procedures because of rate of approval and uniform claims form, there's four meetings. And health benefits, they've got nine meetings listed and probably takes more than that. Just going through this list, I'm not trying to be negative here, but I just don't think that $31,000 is realistic to have a good public hearing process in the governor's bill. It would be realistic if it was $200,000 in the other bill, but from $1 million to $31,000 is too big a gap, and there's not going to be any consumer involvement. So I'd ask you to relook at that. I don't think that's a good figure. Let's don't lowball that. Let's be realistic.
Senator Salo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was sort of struggling with the same thing about the differences here. Plus, I think that the Commissioner of Administration the other day did a good job of explaining to us that these bills take a very different focus, and we all know that 270 takes more of a study the problem focus, in which case I would assume that you'd have, if anything, a greater expenditure in the public process rather than less. So, I'm confused by that amount of disparity there, too. Unless I'm missing something about the public process in the approach that we take in 284, I mean, is there some reason why it should be significantly more extensive? And that's a legitimate question.
Mr. Chairman, we did base this on our experience, which is. I don't know whether other divisions and on other issues they would find it comparable, but we tried to do the best job we could of making the list and figuring out what it was going to cost. That said, you know, at least half the time when we set our own hearings, we guess wrong and we think, boy, this is going to take 2 days and there's 5 minutes worth of testimony, and other times we think, you know, this is going to be in and out. We'll do it from eight to ten, and we'll be done. And 2 days later, you know, we're done with the first three speakers. So there is a big disparity. I also have to say that I think this is a number where you could almost throw a dart at a board and come up with an estimate, because who knows? I mean, I think when we get to some issues. Benefit package, you know, and the issue of reproductive rights, that's going to be a very long public hearing. some of the others on the list may conceivably be short. So, I mean, we think this is a fairly reasonable estimate based upon the template we did for 284, but I'm kind of glad I don't have to manage the budget either way, because I wouldn't have a lot of confidence that I could make the budget.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with Mr. Walsh on 284 necessarily. I think $1 million for a good public involvement process may be right. My disagreement is with the administration's lowball. I mean, $31,000 doesn't do. I mean, we've all sat through hearings on this issue, and let me tell you, this is not going to be a 5-minute hearing on any topic relating to this issue. I just think it's a lowball figure.
On 270, was there an honorarium paid to the members the way that there is in 284?
No, Mr. Chairman. The members of the commission, the three members of the commission, are full-time paid staff.
Oh, okay. There's a salary cost instead. Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I hate to keep dwelling on this, but I am really focused on this defining a range of potential packages. And I assume that what you're envisioning is you'd bring back a package and say, for example, it'd be like in the format of, for example, you could have this, and would it also say it would cost this much, basically?
Mr. Chairman, I guess the way I look at this is that I think the way this would probably work is that folks would sit down and they would define a benefit package, and then they would start costing that benefit package and take a look at the cost. And then they would go back and try to figure out, I think the reality is then they would go back and try to figure out what a lower cost package would look like. And so what I think coming out of that you would have is maybe a lower cost benefit package, and then a medium cost, and then a higher cost, to try to get some range of what seems to be possible.
What would you define as low cost?
I guess I would define low cost as being something that was basically catastrophic.
Major medical. Catastrophic.
Catastrophic coverage. Dave may have a better handle on that than I, but just...
Dave, what would you...
Jay is right, Mr. Chairman. It would be... I think about the lowest cost package you could come up with would be a major medical or catastrophic package that provided for very high deductible and limited things like long-term or nursing home care, did not concentrate on wellness. It basically would be a disaster plan.
Catastrophic, I mean after you've lost $3,000, it kicks in.
Yeah, or five.
Or more.
Five, yeah. And it would only cover hospitalization after a week or something like that. But the triggers to get into the plan would be set very, very high.
You have any kind of guess what the monthly premium would be on that? Actually, you have you introduced a couple of people in your staff that were like medical insurance experts, or
well, Thelma Walker, who's the deputy, she's here, and also
come up? I'm curious about
Barbara this. Thurston and Katie Campbell, who are our actuaries.
Why don't you have them come up?
Thelma, I think would be
Thelma. Okay.
The only really, I don't want to say experiment. The only thing that we've done that would be instructive would be the two pools that we put together based upon legislation passed last year and the year before, one for a high-risk pool and one for small business. The high-risk pool assumes that economics is not really a consideration. It's the pre-existing condition that's the problem. The small employer pool does assume economics is a consideration. Thelma had the responsibility for putting both of those programs together.
Right now we have...
State your name for the record.
I'm Thelma Walker, Deputy Director for the Division of Insurance. We have been looking at the high-risk pool, for example, which has a $1,500 deductible, and most of the people are enrolling in that with that deductible. The cost for that plan, however, or that pool, is based on a number of things, age, geographical area, and... So when you are doing rates, they are done by age bands. In that particular pool for the $1,500 deductible, you are looking at $165 per month. And remember now, this is high risk. So the person is coming in with a disability. So for $165 a month, that's for ages up to 25. So it increases with the increase of age.
Sure.
If you're looking at a 10, that we have been kicking around those deductibles for the high-risk pool, and we've put some numbers together as high as a $10,000 deductible. And so if you're looking at a $10,000 deductible, your premium will be less than $100 a month for ages up to 25.
Wow. Yeah. If you had a, obviously you must have looked hard into the issues of adverse selection in a pool
yes.
like that.
Yes.
Or even in the legislation passed last year, which has much less adverse selection capabilities, but there have to be some in there. If you wiped that out and said that there was really a hypothetical, statistically average cross-section of individuals enrolled, what do you think a catastrophic coverage would cost in terms of monthly premium?
If you mandated?
If you said that, yeah, well, or somehow you got to a point where the enrollees in the pool were a statistical average of the population at large, whether it was mandatory or not, if you could make that kind of assumption.
With the spread of the risk, and we aren't talking about high risk, but a spread of
yes.
the risk,
yes.
including high risk.
Averaged right in with the low risk.
Okay. A couple of hundred dollars for about a $10,000 deductible.
Per year?
No, per month.
Well, I thought you just said it would be less than that for a $1,500.
Well, you were saying an average. There's a difference between averaging it and putting it on age bands. Okay, if you average it, okay, you're taking the high and the low in averaging.
Okay, so what was
okay.
I'm sorry, so I missed something. Go back to your high-risk pool where you said
okay.
that there was...
The high-risk pool... The high-risk pool rates are based on basically age bands, and that the age bands are made up of ages as well as geographical areas.
Okay.
Okay. So you might have the age band will be less than 18 to 25, 25 to 30, 30 to 35, and the older you are, the higher the rates. Okay, now, I'm not an actuary, so I don't know what all of the numbers that go in to get the age bands and so forth. So when you say average, then in establishing benefit plans, you look at the high and the low and average it. And that's why I said a couple of hundred dollars for your $10,000 deductible. Now, if you're going to look at an age band, a scenario, then it could be lower than that, less than $100 for less than age 18.
Well, I guess I have to believe your testimony. It's hard to imagine that high risk, I mean, it would seem to me, just intuitively, that a high risk pool would be like tenfold higher in premium than an average risk pool.
In some cases, they are, but the pool that was passed in the state of Alaska has a maximum percentage in which those rates can be charged. There's a stop. There's a limit on the increase that those rates can be over the average increase.
It's 150%.
Well, right now it's 175%. There was a maximum of 200%. Of the average within the age bands. See, what we did, we took an average from five insurers, age banded out, and increased that rate by 175% to get the high-risk pool rates.
Okay. And you told me what the rate was for the under 25 age band?
Yes.
What's the rest of that, those rates?
Well, it's I don't remember them all, but you have at age six, between age 60 and 64, you're looking at $642 per month.
And what's the deductible?
For a $500 deductible. For the $1,500 deductible, you're looking at half of that.
Okay. Senator Duncan?
Is it possible, though, that even when you're allowed to increase 175%, right? The premium can be 175% higher, is that what you said?
Yeah, of the average, yes.
The average. Mm-hmm. So it's possible even at that premium would be, if there wasn't that limit, that premium would be higher yet.
Well, the limit in the Act itself,
right, right,
is 200%.
Right. But without that limit, if they were to charge really what they think they need to charge for the premium in order
it would be much higher.
So
yes.
The point being, I was trying to make is, that's an artificial limit, which means you and I pay for the cost of that high-risk pool.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because of the cost shifting that goes on, because they are not allowed to charge what they really would like to charge in order to insure themselves against those losses, so they shift it over to us.
Okay, so those losses get charged against insurers.
Which
yes,
is why,
Mr. Chairman.
If you
okay.
make the assumption of either a mandatory participation or participation on a full spectrum as opposed to adverse selection, the cost doesn't go down that much, because the true cost is of those pools is not reflected in the premiums that are set. So you can't do the arithmetic and make it work, because the numbers for the pools are less than what it costs.
Yeah.
To underwrite that risk.
Are these rates per individual?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
No family rates or anything?
No. Not on the high risk pool.
How about the policies that are either in development or promulgated for the small business group insurance? What kind of numbers are those?
We haven't developed numbers yet. We haven't developed numbers. The benefit packages will be what is already offered, currently offered within the marketplace. But we have not finalized the numbers for that pool yet.
The pool itself hasn't. We wouldn't
no,
finalize
no,
those
we wouldn't
numbers.
Finalize them.
The board has been appointed, and it's kind of their job to do that.
Livy, and then Senator.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you want to get into this discussion, but there are obvious limitations to the benefit of catastrophic policies, in the sense that only a few people ever really benefit from them, and you lose the whole issue of preventative care and preventive services and the whole range of services that normally would be provided in a plan, and you're pushing people toward the most expensive type of care, which is, you know, very expensive hospital care. So there are obviously trade-offs.
You have. Could I debate this?
I was just going to ask about the small business pool.
I'm looking at testimony that said that the state's insurance plan, which I think is recognized far and wide as a Cadillac plan, is what, $428 a month?
Yeah, or 32 or something like
that. Or something in that neighborhood.
400 and change.
It's a Cadillac. And
it's about what?
And
but
that's
American made.
And that's family coverage, right? I mean, you know, there's some cases where there are two individuals in a family employed by the state, but by and large, it's one individual covering spouse and dependents. And I find it hard to imagine that a catastrophic plan per individual would only be half of that. Senator Duncan.
Well, unless I missed a loop here too, but the reason why the rates they're showing for their catastrophic plan are lower is because they're artificial rates.
Oh no, but the testimony, the answer to my question was no artificial rate. Just if you took every if you had a statistical average cross section, it would be $200 a month, right?
I think that may be a lot.
No, I don't know. May I follow up on this
one? I think that the number would come down if you had some type of mandate, because one of the things that brings the cost of the state policy down is the size of the pool, and the larger it gets, the easier it is to spread the risk. It's one of the problems we have with any type of pooling in the state, because we only have 570,000 people. If that was you know, 5.7 million, it would be much less expensive per individual to spread the risk, and that's why the state policy is less expensive than if you went out as an individual and looked for that type of coverage.
Now, that's why I qualified my question as saying a statistical average, because that, whether it's a large pool or a small pool, if it's an average pool, it's the same. But I'll let Senator Duncan answer his questions. But I want to go on to the consideration of what Mr. Leiby said was a medium policy. I think this is real pertinent to what might be pursued in any of these bills as far as what kind of plans are being talked about. Senator Duncan?
First of all, just to react to your other question, I think before, I mean, it's easy to say, let me just say, that the state plans a Cadillac plan, but that's not necessarily a correct statement. I think you need to compare the benefits that other folks have with the state plan before you make that statement, because I've seen the plans which the benefits are just as good in other plans as they are in the state plan. They pay more because of the smaller pool, but their benefits are the same. I wanted to ask about, and I apologize, but go back to the legislation we passed last year on the small group market. What was the limit on that? On the catastrophic illness, it was 175% of the average premium, which most of you charged, right?
It was 200 was the cap.
And what, what is it on the legislation we passed last year? Just refresh my memory. Maybe you know.
There isn't a cap, is there?
I thought it was 175. That was my memory. Might have been
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, there isn't a cap on the small employer. Only in the increases after a certain date. And in the Small Employer Reinsurance Association, this is the one that was passed last year, okay? There are some caps in there relative to renewals and how much that increase can be of the current. Now, Katie, our life and health actuary, is working on those numbers.
We don't need to discuss
it.
But it wasn't anything
CPI
like
thing,
a one,
you know,
yeah. One to the index.
Yeah, I'd like to discuss it. We don't need to.
Yeah, we don't need to. My memory was really different than that. I thought that there was a range around a center point, and if you went beyond, you could only go up to that point, and if that didn't cover you, you had the option of either eating it or buying the or I don't know what you call it, but the pool, reinsurance pool, if you went beyond the band, or absorb it, you know. And that's how I thought it worked, but I guess we'll discuss it
later.
Okay.
I don't think that's what finally came out.
Well, repeal the whole thing, because that's not what he meant.
Oh. Yeah. Well, whatever's in the bill is what I meant. Could you go on to what you would regard as a medium plan?
Dave can help me out here. I guess I would view a medium plan as one that didn't have as many. Maybe preventive services, maybe not quite as much dental coverage, not quite as much optometry coverage, and had higher deductibles and copays.
Yeah.
And how much more
some
than a
pregnancy, but not everything.
Yeah, maybe.
How much more than a catastrophic premium would that probably be?
It, I don't mean to be flip, Mr. Sherman, but it's kind of like buying an automobile, and for every piece of chrome or CD player or electric window or whatever, it's going to ratchet it up. And if you picked a mid-level, you know, I don't know, you'd probably get to very, very quickly, you could get to $300 a month without any trouble. And then if you wanted to tailor it to your particular needs, to add things like full pregnancy coverage, et cetera, you could go to $350 before you knew what hit you.
Family or individual?
Probably the $350, you could probably get family coverage, maybe.
Senator Salem?
And a group.
Well, one thing that has just been confusing me the whole time I've listened to this catastrophic insurance discussion is, aren't there plans on the market now that are not nearly that expensive? The Blue Cross Basic one, for instance?
The Blue Cross Basic plan is in the neighborhood of $150, I think, but that is very bare bones. That is major medical with a high deductible, no preventive types of things. They, it's good for what it is.
It's more than catastrophic.
But yes, it's more than catastrophic, but it's definitely a major medical type plan. The triggers are very high.
A follow-up. Is it also premiumed based on age bands that Thelma's described?
Yes.
Okay, because my daughter had it and it was much less even than that. It was maybe $57.
Then she must have been young and pretty healthy.
Right.
Obviously, very young.
A mere child.
Yeah. Oh, we've been joined by Senator Leo.
part of the problem, and the costs just, the cost of insurance just, it gets staggering. But part of the problem is that when you use it, it's also very expensive. I spent 2 days in the hospital in November of last year, and the bill was like $3,000 or $4,000. And, you know, you got to pay a lot of premiums at $150 a month to amortize that cost. So,
other questions on the fiscal notes or on insurance rates?
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would just ask Mr. Leiby to relook. I mean, based on the schedule that Mr. Walsh did on 284 on the public hearings for benefit packages, et cetera, relook at the public hearing process. I just think it's not adequate.
Will do.
I'll just say that, you know, it seems to me that we've now gone through the a long list of proposals for improving the efficiency in healthcare, the public health aspects, and the one where there doesn't seem to be really good information or even conjecture is on the cost of any specific benefit package. And it's actually, I suppose, a feeling that I've had all along, even back when I was listening to what the president was proposing, that I didn't trust his numbers on what it would cost. So, you know, I'm going to try to gather up all the proposals in here and see what we can piece together, but I definitely agree that you can't have a consensus on what you want to do unless you know the cost. And I think we should perhaps give more specific direction to either the governor's bill or whatever, or the committee, commission, whatever it is, about what we want to have researched and brought back to say what would be in it and what would it cost. Because I think we're going to continue to get this kind of answer, not because it's being evasive, but no one knows. And and you can't just march out and say we're going to do it if you don't know, you don't even have a ghost of an idea of what it would cost. Senator Salo.
I think an additional frustration with that point is that health care costs and consequently premium costs are changing so rapidly that I think if we're not going to move forward on something until we know that, I don't think that's something we're ever going to really know with absolute certainty.
No, you never know.
Or sort of like swimming upstream or something.
You never know with absolute certainty. My point, though, is that I think that a lot, and this, I guess, just an observation, a lot of the debate on healthcare has focused on the benefits and how wonderful it would be. And you just don't hear about what the costs are. And I think it's the same way that we launched into Medicare, Medicaid, whatever else. And I'd like to see us have good data on those points. Senator Duncan.
I think that's a good point, and I don't disagree with you, but I think, and I don't know how we get to this either, but I think we can, is that we can't just look at the cost. We also got to look at the savings that are generated by having, depending on what kind of principles we adopt, but a principle of universal coverage where everybody has a preventive health care plan. There may be some initial costs, but there's a long-term savings because your health care cost overall should be going down. So part of the charge also should be one of the things we should be looking at, we shouldn't just look at, it's going to cost X millions of dollars to do this because of new costs. We should be looking at the long-term savings that are going to be generated. And I think most people agree that savings are going to outweigh the cost. Even if you just slow down the inflationary spiral from here to here, right? and you do that through preventive health care and universal coverage and everything else, there's a great savings for government and businesses and individuals. So we got to wrap that into the formula somehow. Okay.
That's a good point, and I'm glad you pointed it as here versus here, because I tend to share that view. I think that some of the pronouncements that have been made, not here locally, of course, are that things will cost less in the future if there were health care reform. And whether or not there is, I think the present outrage over 14% of GDP going into health care is going to be low compared to what it'll be in the future. And I think that the expectation that is sometimes put out there that we'll get it back to 5% or whatever it was in the 1950s is just not there.
And I want you to know, Mr. Chairman, I know you recognize that. I have never said that we're going to spend less next year than we're spending this year. I think the goal only is to slow down the rate of increase, not that we're going to reduce overall spending. It's not realistic. It should not be what we're talking about.
Okay. Anything else, committee members? Thank you for the fiscal notes. Appreciate them. Try to gather all the hearings you've had and bring something to us. Senator Salo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one area, and maybe it was because I was had to be somewhere else or whatever, but the one area that I felt like wasn't as thoroughly covered in hearings in our study was the public health area. I don't know how you feel about that.
You might not have been here that day. I did ask the Department of Health and Social Services to give a presentation on Healthy Alaskans 2000, not to repeat what we did back in December, mm-hmm. But specific listing of legislative action that they'd like to see, and that meeting lasted 15 minutes. You know, there were no legislative proposals that anybody wanted to propose. I think that when I look through the Healthy Alaskans 2000, actually some of the proposals there had to do with alcohol and tobacco taxes. There's some health education curriculum recommendations. What else is in there? But if you read that report, it's that thick. There was a long laundry list of recommendations, many of which would have required legislation. But, you know, we'll have to go back and look and see what's in there ourselves that we might want to propose. I'd recommend that report to you, and if you want to bring proposals, be glad to entertain them. And there's a lot of good ideas in there. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what your next plan is. I know we've talked, we sort of initial overview, I think, of both proposals and then talked about some specific issues, but I would just like to, I don't know if you hit all those issues you want to. I think there's three or four issues that we haven't taken individually and looked at, and I just wanted to bring those to your attention and ask if they'd be perhaps considered to be looked at individually as part of, before we start making a decision where we're going to go here with this. One is just the principle of universal coverage and whether or not that's what we want to direct the commission to focus on, universal coverage, or are we not interested in that? I believe that universal coverage needs to be part of any package, and that should be the direction that we direct any commissioner authority to go to. And I don't know if we're all in tune on that or not, but if not, I think we should explore that and the pros and cons of universal coverage versus access and how I might accomplish that as a separate issue. Secondly, I think it's possible, or I think one of the components of any plan and what a commission should begin looking at initially would be designing a cost control system. Whatever that means to you or to me, that's what we should be asking the commission to look at, because part of any reform has to be somehow slowing down the inflationary cost. And I'm not advocating, I would advocate what's in 284, but there should be some direction to the commission to begin looking at how a cost control system could be designed and implemented. And I think that's a separate issue we could discuss here as a specific issue before we start moving forward. Third would be just a whole question of wellness and preventive health care and how, what type of direction we want to give to any commission to explore that. And the fourth issue, which we haven't discussed at all yet, which I think is really important, which I don't think we should ignore in this state, is long-term care. Do we want to direct the commissions to take a look at the long-term care and how we fold that into some type of data or
approaches brought back by a commission. Those are four issues I don't, and maybe there's more if I thought about, but just here in the last minute, four issues I don't think we've discussed in division and committee, which I think bear some, at least minimal discussion. Some of these issues we spent 10 minutes on, some we spent an hour on, but those seem to be four areas that we haven't covered individually.
Those are points well taken, although I know that with respect to universal or single, are you talking about universal or single payer?
No, I'm not talking about single payer. I mean, there's ways, there may be ways. I've become convinced that the only way we get to universal coverage is single payer. I'm talking about the idea of everyone has basic health care policy, not just universal access, because, you know, everybody has that at some point in the system. If you get deathly ill, you go to the hospital and they take care of you. But universal coverage, designing a system is that the underlying principle being universal coverage. I think we should have a discussion of that in committee. I think universal coverage, whether it's through a, I think single payer system is the way to do it, but whether it's an employer mandate and a public program that supplements that, like Hawaii has or whatever it might be, we should identify that as a principle and understand the differences and be able to give the commission direction to approach that way. If this committee decides universal coverage is not a good idea, then we shouldn't be directing the commission to explore universal coverage. So I think that issue, actually in my mind, that's probably the first issue of any comprehensive reform package is, what do you mean? Do you want universal coverage or do you not?
I guess I'll respond a little. I don't think that, I think my point is that it's hard to know whether you want that to be a principle until you know what it costs.
Well, I guess my response would be, I don't think it's that difficult because we know what it costs not to have universal coverage and what it's doing to the system. And I think the question that I ask of Mr. Walsh about what's happening, because, you know, catastrophic, finally people who can't get insurance get into a catastrophic pool and they pay 175% or 200% of premium, but it costs a whole lot more, right? So the cost shifted over. Well, that's what's happening to everybody who doesn't have health care. When they finally get covered, they can't pay their bill, is all cost shifted over. Bartlett Hospital has 18, 20 percent, may I ask Mr. Just as an example, Mr. Nelson, for example, Bartlett, how much of the compensated care do they have?
It would be in the 15 to 20%.
Yeah, 15 to 20%. Let me tell you, those folks aren't just swallowing that. They're cost shifting it over to everybody else. So without universal coverage, there's a great cost involved. So it's not the cost of doing it, it's the cost of not doing it.
I think an argument like that would be fleshed out in any kind of analysis of what costs are under various proposals versus the status quo. I mean, if what you're saying is true, and I'm not saying it's not true, that would come forward when the kind of analysis that needs to be done gets done.
I guess my point was, I think that's an issue that's worth, and you're the chairman, so, but that's an issue that's worth debating as a bottom line issue and getting consensus that that's where we want to direct the commission to do, is look at a system that design, a system, no matter what it might be, it's a universal coverage system, not just one that says those who can afford it are going to have health insurance.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to engage in a lengthy debate with Senator Duncan on this issue, but it was talking about cost shifting. You know, I still would maintain that a universal coverage single payer system would be an even greater cost shifting scheme, especially if it's community based and not experientially based. And there's going to be a massive cost shifting. While we have cost shifting now to cover people who don't have coverage, I recognize that. I think that we would probably be orders of magnitude greater in the amounts of cost shifting if we were to go into something like that. So we have to recognize that, you know, it's going to be there. It just may be many more people incrementally involved in the cost shifting rather than the large amounts that we see in the hospital.
Senator Sharp.
Chairman, to expand on that a little bit, my concern goes also to major potential for major cost shifting from other agencies now bearing part of the health care cost, to, shifting it to the state of Alaska and then backing out. And that's to one of the problems we might face if Alaska steps forward and has a universal health care package and it becomes a primary carrier for everybody. So that would have to be addressed to avoid the cost shifting from federal agencies and everything else to the state plan.
Those are all legitimate points, and of course, with all the things that we have to look at as we design a system, a comprehensive system, but you know, probably at some point, universal coverage is going to be nationwide, not just on a state-by-state basis. And I guess my only and another response is, if we don't think that some of those federal agencies are backing out now, look what's being proposed for IHS funding on the federal level. Let me tell you, mm-hmm. there's going to be a tremendous amount of cost shifting going on if IHS funding is cut to the level that at least initially President Clinton was talking about. I mean, so that shouldn't scare us away. It should encourage us to get into the design system.
We ought to be aware of what the total impact could be all of a sudden. Gradual backing away isn't that painful.
That's right, just been detained, I guess, gradual in the president's budget.
Sort of sneaks up on
that. Senator Salem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know this is probably taking more time, but I think it's a healthy debate on one of the key issues anyway.
No problem.
In my mind, though, when I think about universal coverage, I don't think about it only in terms of dollars and cost shifting and how that's going to change. My teacher background to think about lots of little kids that I've taught that didn't have, never got their teeth fixed, and only got their earaches taken care of when it was an emergency room visit in the middle of the night, and which is a very inefficient method of healthcare. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, those little kids who weren't covered, they weren't necessarily from welfare families. They were from the working poor. And I think that we have a duty to work on universal coverage for them and for those reasons, in as well as you know, the bottom line on finances and what premiums are going to cost.
Senator Sharp.
Just to keep us rolling a little longer, that is true, but also a lot of it is attributable to misplaced priorities, no matter what the income level is. So that shift would occur to the state.
I think I know what you're saying.
Family misplaced priorities.
And I chime in to say that if you have the facts, all the facts in front of you, a consideration such as you've raised doesn't mean that it can't be factored in. It's a legitimate consideration, but you need to know. I mean, we also have a responsibility to be fiscally responsible, and can't just march out a mandate and say, "Well, you will do this, but by the way, we don't know what it's going to cost you." I mean, that's not realistic either. The ingredient that's I'm repeating myself. The ingredient that's missing the most in debates on healthcare is what it costs. All the other things get fleshed out pretty well. Senator Duncan.
I agree with you on that. Unfortunately, and I think we got to get that answer. I think we have to get that answer, what it costs. And if I could just digress a moment, 284 gets you that answer. Under a delivery system of universal coverage and under a specific benefit plan, and it gets the answer how much it's going to cost and brings it back to us and says, okay, here's the alternative. Here's what it's going to cost, or if you don't do that, you wait for the federal government. 270 doesn't get you that answer. The governor's proposal doesn't get you that answer because it doesn't say to do that. It says, put together a data system, to collect data, see what kind of data we need. Says, look at alternative benefit plans. It comes back, we'll be sitting here, maybe we should do this, but we'll be sitting here 2 years from now if we do the governor's bill, and we'll have five different alternatives before us, and we'll all be shaking our head in disgust and walking away. The way you get to consensus is you come back with a plan that the public will accept. That's why it's a $1 million public involvement plan in 284. because the public is really involved. And when the legislature, when the commission comes back to legislature, they've got a plan that the public has said, you like the benefits, you know how much it's going to cost, and here's a recommendation on how to pay for it, but we make the final decision. But we don't have multiple decisions to make, we only have one decision to make. The governor's plan will have multiple decisions to make. I'll be so old and gray by the time this thing finishes. I need the long-term care plan.
Anything else? Okay, Senator Hessinger.